And welcome back to Mother Tongue, your extra set of eyes, ears, and finger on the pulse for all parents around the world. I'm Marianne.
And I'm Sarah. We are your co-hosts. We catch up weekly, chatting with experts, people of interest, and mamas from around the world to discuss everything relating to parenthood.
Listen in to hear more on navigating mamahood, the products we swear by, and the experiences we've been through during pregnancy, motherhood, work, and beyond.
Let's get going, shall we?
It's autumn and we've had so much rain, and I don't want to start this episode by complaining, but what a week it's been. And it also it's going to get really, really hot. I'm supposed to be going on a day out to Dubai Safari tomorrow, and it's going to be highs of 29.
Is it?
Yeah, I know.
After all that rain.
I know.
And hailstones.
Hail? You had hailstones?
Did you not see in... It wasn't Alco's, but somewhere nearby, like golf ball size hailstones. I'll find you the video. It was like white snow in the morning, covered.
Stop it.
I'm going to find it.
Yeah, I'm kind of sad that I missed out on that hailstorm in Dubai. It was wild, though.
Why cloud seed in half term when everyone's at home with the kids?
I know. We had a day of cabin fever. Actually, we went to the gym, didn't we?
We did.
Got to 9 a.m. I was like, get me out. Must leave. But actually, do you know what? One great thing about half term, we normally put the kids into camp for at least a few days. And this year I was like, nah, you know, weather's so nice. They can go to the park, they can play, we can do stuff. And actually, it's been so nice to not one have to rush to get out in the morning,
transport back and forth,
yeah, just to chill, it's just been so nice to be like, oh yeah, if you don't want to eat breakfast right now, you can eat it in an hour, no big deal. And it's also been really nice not to have to do pickup. So today I went shopping at M&S I was in there for like 2 hours. I went to the really, really big one, which I try and do at least every quarter. And I was hoping and praying that their Easter collection would be in there. And I was sadly informed that Easter chocolate has not arrived to the UAE yet. So instead, I got Valentine's goodies and then raided their sale and checked out their new spring summer collection. I mean, it was great. I bought 2 cushions, 2 amazing green and white stripy cushions with like a frilly edge.
I saw.
29 dirhams each.
That's
29
nice.
Dirhams, guys. I mean, that is like a bargain of dreams, basically. I mean, I was over the moon. Oh, do you know what? I love M&S for an occasion. I just, every occasion, I feel like they nail Christmas. I'm like, I'm there. Easter, I'm there. Valentine's Day, I'm there. Halloween, I mean, I'm there. Every time. And they do amazing sales. I loved my trip today. I did walk around with a packet of discounted salmon in my hand, like nibbling at it. People must have thought, oh God, that woman is so weird.
And smells,
yeah.
What is the spring summer collection like?
So what they've dropped so far is incredible. There's lots of like gorgeous scalloped edged swimsuits and bikinis. I love a scalloped edge still. I know they're probably not in fashion anymore. I don't really understand fashion, but I...
Scalloped.
Okay. It's a scallop. Yeah, you're right. It's not a scallop. It's a scallop. A scallop is something you eat. A scallop. But yeah, no, really gorgeous linen pieces. Lots of like really soft muslin pieces as well.
Nice.
There's some gorgeous things. Raided it all. Had a great time. And do you know what the silver lining is? Is if you are based here in the UAE, M&S have launched their own website in the UAE. So now you can get all the bargains and all the great things online, which I'm very excited about. So the guy was like, the man at the store was like, Easter homeware will be coming soon in about 1 week. So keep your eyes peeled online. I was like, I will.
I worry for you with your holiday shopping and that easy access to M&S.
I know. I worry for me too. I constantly worry for me. I've also, today, people, obviously we're recording this semi in advance to when we release it. It's Lent. Today's the first day of Lent. It's also Valentine's Day, which I think is a really cruel trick.
So we had Pancake Day, Lent, and Valentine's Day within 2 days.
Well, Shrove Tuesday is the last day before Lent, always. So I feel like one comes with the other, always. Anyway, this year I've decided that I am going to give up chocolate for Lent.
Do you have a headache yet?
No. Not yet, but it's been half a day.
Sugar crash.
To be fair, yeah, half a day. I feel like my addiction to chocolates has gone to a whole new level. And I think because I'm like, oh, but I exercise so much, I kind of justify the fact that it's okay to eat really poorly. And I have been eating pretty poorly since Christmas. So I'm excited to see if I can do this, but I'm not sure I will. And I boshed a bag of mini eggs last night just to say bye to the chocolate for the next 40 days and 40 nights.
I worry about you when it's over and then the Easter descends and the Easter egg hunts and all the mini eggs and everything.
I think Easter day I'll exclusively just eat mini eggs. Nothing else, just mini eggs and chocolate. It will be great. It will be a great day. But yeah, I'm actually probably going to have to just ignore M&S's Easter chocolate bonanza because I'm not going to be able to eat anything until Easter day. I was thinking I'd quite like to have an Easter party, but maybe not. What's wrong with me? Love an event. Why do I like toast so much? I'm a weirdo. Must stop.
If you have one, I'm here because I've done nothing for Easter.
That's fine. I mean, it's February. Rightly so. No one should have done anything for Easter. I'm the only weirdo who's bought like pop-up paper chickens and weird eggs to like prop around my house.
Of course you have.
What's wrong with me? I feel like I need to stop. Anyway, we've got a really exciting episode today and I'm very, very excited. I feel like I have been hounding Spencer and Vogue's people to come on my podcast, for the best part of 3 years. 3 years. It's been a long time.
You just got to wear these people down.
Yeah, you do. I mean, persistence is key here. Persistence pays off, people, because today we are speaking to Spencer Matthews. And I mean, I'm not even going to keep it a secret because I'm so excited. It was a great chat.
It was so good.
I really liked it. I was a bit nervous. I came out, I had big sweat patches under my arms. It was not a good look. Luckily, he only saw our face and he didn't see the rest, which was good because I was, you know, head down, not in a great way. Very excited. But yeah, it was fab.
It was. He was great. And he did say, and we have it recorded, that he would be happy to come on again.
Yeah, I know. We're just going to need to remind him of this. Yeah. Hopefully he'll listen to this. Oh, do you think he re-listens to podcasts?
I hope so.
Do you think you would if you were famous and, you know, were on a podcast? Do you think you'd re-listen? I don't think I would. I mean, I don't like to listen to our own podcast. We're not famous, but I hate the sound of my own voice. It makes me feel a bit nauseous. Sarah actually has to exclusively listen back to all our podcasts now because I hate listening to myself.
Not sure how I agreed to this, but yes.
Yeah, it's a great one. Well, this is back when you had your long commutes, which, you know, made anyway, something Spencer actually forgot to mention on the podcast, which was quite all, is that him and his wife are coming to Dubai Opera on the 19th of April to do a live podcast, which I think is epic. Love that he didn't mention that, but I'm going to mention it now. So guys, if you want to see Spencer and Vogue at Dubai Opera, tickets are now on sale. You can buy them at Platinum List or I think lots of other places, but yeah, we got ours at Platinum List. It's going to be an unfiltered live show, and I promise you, it will be hilarious. If you haven't listened to their podcast already, it's brilliant. Lots of balls.
We'll be there.
I like all their podcasts. I like the one that Vogue does with Joanne McNally.
Yes.
I mean, that is hilarious. Lots of balls. And I like Big Fish as well that Spencer does. I haven't listened to the one that he does with Jamie Lang.
No, that's next on the list.
Yeah, maybe you listen and tell me if it's worth a listen. I feel like I'm podcast out sometimes. I'm going to link that in the show notes. So if you guys want to go and see them, do it. And I think without further ado,
let's get going, shall we?
Today's guest found fame appearing on Made in Chelsea and his career has gone from strength to strength ever since. From his early days on screen, he has transcended his reality TV persona to become a successful entrepreneur, broadcaster, husband and father to three gorgeous children. He has also become well known for his appearances on British TV and adventure sports feeds, and is also the founder of CleanCo, a company that has been making waves throughout the industry by offering a unique variety of clean, low alcohol beverages. With an entrepreneurial spirit and a cracking personality, we are so incredibly excited to welcome Spencer Matthews to Mother Tongue. Spencer, welcome. How are you?
I'm alarmingly well, delighted to be with you girls and looking forward to the chat.
Are you delighted that January is over? Everyone in the UK has been complaining how January felt like it went on for an entire year. And we're now in February, so you must be ecstatic.
January is one of my favourite months of the year.
Oh my God, really?
Well, firstly, it's a month where lots of people kind of readdress their relationship with alcohol, albeit temporarily. So it's great for business for me. But also from a personal perspective, it's kind of like, it's a real opportunity to kind of hit the ground running. I always feel really motivated in January because it's the start of the year. Mm. And I know that lots of people don't think that way about January, but I don't know, January always really excites me. It tees you up for, I don't know, how you mean to carry on, I suppose, for the year. Like Vogue and I had an awesome January, worked really hard, were incredibly fit and healthy. I don't know, it just felt great. This year in particular with the kids has been one of the best starts to any year, basically.
Do you know what? That gives me a lot of hope because you're now dad of three. And I have two kids. We both have two relatively young kids, similar age to your elder two, actually. And I'm kind of in that. I was always like, no, I'm two and done. And now I'm like, oh, God, maybe I want a third. And you saying that life is okay with three, I mean, that kind of makes me feel good. That makes me feel good because I'm actually terrified at the thought of three.
That's not to say, and by the way, anyone who says, oh, there's not that much difference, two to three, there is.
Oh, really?
There is. Oh, yeah, God. Yeah, no, there is. There's not, in my opinion, there's not that much difference one to two because you're so obsessed with the firstborn and getting everything right and making sure that, you know, they're doing everything that they should be at their age. Mm-hmm. Kind of by the time the second one comes along, you feel like a bit of a pro almost, in my opinion. So it's kind of less pressure on the seconds. The third is a bit of a handful. There is a lot more to do. We had three under the age of four at one point. Mm-hmm. And it's just, and like, you know, take this morning as an example, like two of them were just on really bad form. It's not quite the like get up and go morning that you're after.
No. I mean, the get up and go mornings, they're long gone. It's like get up and get stressed. I actually now try and get up.
Yeah.
I try and get up an hour before they get up just so I can drink a coffee on my own in the dark with no one talking to me. And then when they get up, it's just like, oh, God, I'll do whatever you want. Just shout at me for now.
That's the move, though. Mm. Like, and that's a real strong move. Because by the time they're up, you're ready for it.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse, actually, than getting up at a similar time where you're trying to navigate that first, like, half hour of your day.
Mm. And you're still in your pyjamas.
And they're just as they always are. So good move.
Yeah.
I like that.
Have you always wanted kids, then? Has kids always been on your radar?
Absolutely.
Oh, that's nice.
They were always on my radar in a kind of like idyllic sense of I can't wait to be a father and have kids. And I was a huge Disney fan, right? So it's just I always wanted this, you know, beautiful relationship with kids. And I've always been fascinated and loved children. But no, I didn't like I wasn't chasing being a father until I met Vogue.
That's really nice.
And I mean, I'm going to have to ask the question now. How did you meet Vogue? We love Vogue, by the way. I have to say that I'm going to ask at the end of this podcast for you to just write a little post-it note to your wife and say, I spoke to Marianne at Mother Tongue today and she wants to have you on the podcast. This is going to be my little...
Yes.
We love her.
We'll sort her out. And this is something I just have to live with now. My wife just being like everyone's favourite. She's far more popular than me. People talk to me to get to my wife. If I turn up to, you know, a dinner party or a lunch and my wife's not there, people are really disappointed. That's just something that I have grown used to. But like, and it's not even like I'm obsessed with her, right? So it's kind of like I'm not even that bothered by it, to be honest. It kind of gets me off the hook for a lot of things as well. But it's great, and I'll certainly put in a good word for her to jump on. She's the most phenomenal mother, so I think you'd have a lot to chat to her about. She's excellent. Where did I meet her? You asked. We met filming a television show called The Jump, which was shot in Innsbruck. And the concept of The Jump, for those that are unfamiliar with it, they basically, they gather a group of people, about 10 to 12 people, many of whom are professional athletes and some of whom are kind of television personalities, to add the kind of colour to it, I suppose. Not that athletes aren't colourful. And then they whack you in a kind of Winter Olympics format. And you go to Innsbruck. Basically, you enter these contests that you would do if you were in the Winter Olympics. So downhill skiing, slalom, bunch of other things, skeleton bobsleigh, all this stuff that none of us have any experience doing, obviously.
Oh my God. I remember watching this. It looks so dangerous.
It's great. And then the losers of each round have to ski jump against each other. And whoever messes up the ski jump or doesn't jump the furthest gets eliminated from the show. And Vogue and I met competing on that. We hit it off straight away as well. Like I joked on the very first day that we ever met that we would get married. And obviously then I spent the rest of my time trying to prove myself right. It was a very funny, kind of cool, awesome relationship from the start, which I think we both, you know, assumed might just be a great friendship.
Hmm.
You know, we weren't desperate to be in a relationship, to be honest, either of us at that stage. But I guess you hear people talking about that kind of thing being why your relationship is so good.
Mm. I mean, I want to hear it all because I feel like it happened all so long ago. I mean, I'm just going to, obviously, I feel like you are a similar age to me, I'm guessing. At least I think so. I could be older than you, which let's not talk about that.
I'm 34.
Hey, okay, snap. That's fine. We can be in the same box. That's all right. So, I mean, obviously we've grown up watching you on our TV screens and I feel like, unlike me, who's been able to grow up without the public watching me at every turn, you've very much grown up in the public eye. But I don't remember how you proposed to Vogue and I don't remember you getting married. Can you tell us a little bit all about that? And then the start of your fatherhood journey, as it were.
Yeah, I can't tell if you're kind of joking about the proposal because Vogue talks about the proposal like it was just like I was trying to do something different and unique and kind of special, but it turned out to just be, well, quite shit, really. It was basically like if you look at all of the options that I probably could have gone with, if I could do it again, I probably would, because I made it, well, a little bit about myself, really, which in retrospect was kind of just a bit stupid. So, as I said earlier, big Disney fan, and the Lion King is, like, I think the Lion King is one of the greatest films to have ever existed. I think it has every identifiable human emotion. I think you're taken on a real journey with it. I actually genuinely believe the Lion King, I'm talking about the cartoon, right, to be insanely powerful and really moving. And I've always loved it. Like, since I was a little kid, I've loved it. I used to play the video games. I love it now. I love the show. Everything to do with the Lion King, actually, I'm a pretty big fan of. Vogue, not so much. So that wasn't her favorite. By any means, and played very little part in her childhood and even less of a part in her adult life. And basically, I got it in my head that I wanted to propose to her on stage at the Lion King.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
How did we not know this story?
Yeah, yeah. No, so I wanted to take her to the Lion King and then I wanted to disappear off, you know, go to the bathroom or whatever, and appear on stage at the Lion King and propose to her in front of, like, you know, a full lyceum of people. And thinking about it now, like, I'm quite glad it didn't turn out that way because she would have hated that. Like, she would have absolutely hated it. But anyway, nonetheless, even despite being told she might hate it, I was kind of gunning for this. Got in touch with the lyceum, got in touch with Disney. Turns out it's like a very professional Disney show that can't be disrupted by some tool from reality television kind of coming on to propose to his girlfriend at the time. But they did say, come and we'll give you a kind of special backstage tour. You can meet the kind of cast. And then, you know, like as the curtain will drop and you can propose there, if you like after the show. And I was just like, yeah, why not? So we went back and we met. Vogue was ill as well this day. She was she had morning sickness because she was pregnant with Theodore. And she was like, can we please cancel the Lion King? I was like, no, we can't cancel the Lion King. We are going to have to go. And anyway, so long story short, we went backstage. We met these characters who were very tired and were probably just looking to go home, who we have, of course, no relationship with whatsoever. And I proposed to her in front of these lions, essentially, who were still in costume, who probably wished they weren't. She did say yes, she accepted, which was great. And then we went home. But then I did think, like, I could have done that in St. Bart's at the Eden Rock, you know, with, like, shooting stars all over the place on the beach or something. And maybe we'll do it again. Maybe we'll do it again. It's a bit late now, to be honest. We are married and we have three kids. But, you know, there could be some kind of renewal of vows or something, perhaps.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I kind of love that. Be bougie.
It's a great story.
It's a bit of a kind of pleasure-pain balance for my thoughts, because, you know, lots of people think it's really cool and really original and really nice and special, and lots of people just think it's absolutely lame. So, you know, it's kind of, yeah. So we're somewhere in between, probably.
You tick the original box. I'll give you that.
So then after you got married, how quickly did you have children? Were you planning them? Were you discussing them straight after you got married? What was the plan?
We agreed to try for kids kind of quite quickly. Like, we realized very early on that we were kind of great for each other and, you know, we would end up together. We weren't too bothered about trying for children like before we got married. It's quite a French thing as well to do that, and, you know, I've kind of grown up primarily with like French culture, if you like. I don't know if we're going to go into childhood or whatever, but I've been around the kind of French culture a lot, and Vogue didn't really mind either about that side of things. So we agreed that we'd kind of not try like aggressively for kids, but just like, you know, whatever happens, knowing that it could take a year or it could take longer. Week later, we're pregnant.
Oh my God.
Wow. Literally, it was immediate, basically. We found out in Amsterdam airport as well. And I remember at the time, like when she told me, I wasn't sure if she was joking or not, because it was literally like 7 days before that she was like, let's try for kids. And I was like, yeah, cool. That sounds fun. and then all of a sudden it was kind of like really real. Our wedding was incredibly casual, and we agreed to get married, you know, later that year. And essentially we had no friends at all, just family wedding. At my parents' place up in Scotland. I like to call it our place. We share everything.
Yeah.
And basically, yeah, ended up at this beautiful part of the world called Glen Affric. It's really, really gorgeous, like secluded, beautiful part of Scotland in the Highlands. And there was like 21 of us, I think, in total. So just like each other's families, that was it. Nothing really, you know, just nice champagne and a cake, I suppose, but nothing grand, no huge guest list, no church even. We got married in front of the house, and it was a really beautiful wedding, actually, and we were delighted with it.
Oh, it sounds perfect.
Private.
Yeah, which is nice, actually, especially when you're both in the public eye so much. It's quite nice to have something that's actually just yours and that no one else really knows about.
Obviously, each to their own with weddings and stuff. But I've been to so many weddings where there's like 300 guests or whatever. Mm. I don't know, 300 people.
No.
Yeah. I would struggle, right, to have 300 people, like particularly if they're just like coming, and that wouldn't be my vibe. And I think we were both quite keen on just like the super small wedding, you know, rather than kind of inviting everyone you've ever met. But again, each their own, and absolutely no issues with whatever people choose to do on their wedding day. But I think we were both quite keen for the smaller thing.
Yeah. Intimate. Yeah.
And was Vogue pregnant at your wedding?
She was, yeah. Oh, she was.
So it wasn't long after you got married that you dropped the sprog, quite literally.
Indeed.
And
yeah, yeah.
How was that? Because I mean, it's... maybe it's different for a man. I don't know. I'm not a man, so I wouldn't be able to comment. But I feel like you get married and then you're like, oh, I have a husband. Mm. And then you have your first kid and it, you know, you've just been living in this like blissful honeymoon phase. And then you go from like really adoring your husband to borderline hating him because he's just useless and doesn't help. And you're up all night and he's sleeping next to you snoring. You're like, fuck you. So how was that experience for you?
Well, it places strain, I think, on any relationship. Yeah. And I think it would be inaccurate to suggest that it doesn't. Vogue is in insanely maternal, right? So she was an excellent mother from the get-go. We had a really kind of, like, I'm a pretty, like, bomb-proof, like, person in general. Like, nothing much bothers me or gets me out of sync. When we went into the hospital to have Theodore, there was an issue with him being born. We had to be rushed into this kind of private surgery room for an emergency C-section. Okay. And it was all pretty intense, right? Because it's like, it's your first kid and it's kind of, you're hoping that things are smooth and you know, we paid to go private and, you know, just so that everything was nice. And you know, as we understand it, as she is, it's pretty much identical, however you do it. Yeah. But anyway, so we paid to go private and all of this kind of began to happen. And I remember thinking, like, Jesus Christ, this is really full on. And Theodore, she was able to give birth normally in the end. But, like, what are those things? You will know what these things are called, and I probably should know what they're called. But Theodore was essentially, like, had a kind of like suction thing put on his head to like help pull him out. And it gave him this like quite long
cone head.
Like it deformed his head essentially temporarily when he was born. And like Dr. Vasso, who was our incredible doctor, handed him over and was just like, oh, by the way, like his head in like a couple of days will be completely normal. But like he had this like long, like have you seen the film Alien? He had this like long, thin head. And it was quite, I remember thinking like, this is not how I expected this to pan out at all. Right. I was hoping for a far like more straightforward experience than this. And the other two were fine. But we took him home, we took photos of him, we sent him to like our parents and people, and it was kind of, there was like a suitable amount of lag in the response for us to know that like the head looked a bit weird. And we knew the head looked a bit weird, by the way. But the doctor was just like, his head will be fine. And I was just like, ah, but it's babies' heads, as you all know, probably listening to this podcast, are not solid to begin with, so they can move. And Theodore, I'm delighted to say, is absolutely beautiful.
Great news.
He's got like a slight, and that's probably nothing to do with me. He looks a bit more like Vogue. He's got this kind of Swedishy look to him, which at first I was, you know, concerned about, but then realized that actually he has like, you know, blonde hair, blue eye thing going on, which I think is pretty epic.
Yeah, nice.
And a normal sized head.
Yeah, which is great. I'm so glad for you. Yeah. I'm glad that your son no longer looks like an alien. That's great. Delighted.
Yeah. It was reassuring, let me tell you, when it went down.
I can imagine. And I mean, you then went from 1 to 2, then 2 to 3 pretty quickly. And I feel like I've noted this because I was following, I think my kids are both 6 months, maybe a bit longer after your kids, but you went very quick. I thought I went quick. You guys, woof, rapid. How was that jump? How was 0 to 1 compared to 1 to 2 compared to 2 to 3, which has been your fave jump, which has been the hardest?
I think you become less and less concerned the more you have. Not to say that you're not concerned about your kids, but you're far more relaxed by the time the third one comes. You're far more relaxed by the time the second one comes along. Mm. You're even more relaxed by the time the third comes along. Yeah, as I've said a number of times in this interview, Vogue's the most exceptional mother. Like her planning and stuff is just, it can be actually quite annoying. She's so kind of like regimented with the planning, but it's a great thing.
You need to be.
Because, you know, because everything flows well. I'm like the sous chef when it comes to parenting. Like I'm available and I can do anything you need me to do. Just ask. Please don't assume that I know what to do, because we're not mind readers, us men. Like we do need some guidance and we do need to be told.
You need
like
a list.
It would be great if you could do this, that, and that. And I'll go, consider it done, my love. Like, I'm happy to do that, no problem. But please don't get to the end of the day and then go, why wasn't this, that, and that done? Because it's like, oh, hang on. Well, I didn't know, actually, that needed doing. So she's the lead. She's the CEO of the household. And I'll be, you know, CMO or the marketing officer or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Why do we think this is? Because I had the same thing. And I mean, it took us a while to realise that I had to be very transparent and straightforward with my husband and just jot it down. Yeah. These are the things I need you to do today. And he'd be like, can do that. No problem. For ages, I would just get to the end of the day and I'd be like, I absolutely despise you. You're useless. You're lazy. You don't help me. I'm just a solo parent feeling so sorry for myself. But how are women wired like one way and how are men wired the other? I mean, there's as a man, can you try and explain that to me? Because I'm still not busy.
No, I unfortunately can't. I'm not a, although I'm deeply interested in neurobiology and I listen to all kinds of podcasts when I run and bits and bobs. I think at the end of the day, the science of it, not that it's particularly scientific, is that men and women are just quite different.
Yeah.
And that is, that there is actually no way around it. I think men and women complement each other really beautifully, actually, in good relationships, which I'm so delighted that I feel I have with my wife. And I'm certain, well, I certainly hope that she feels the same way. But we have kind of grown much, not to sound really lame, but we've grown like much stronger over time. And we know each other's strengths and weaknesses. We are very used to each other. We see each other all the time. We even work together sometimes. things are really have really just kind of fallen into place with us. That period that you were just talking about, where like you rev each other up and it's really annoying. I would get annoyed with Vogue because I was basically the responsible during the night, and so the baby would wake up 15 times, and that's my responsibility apparently. And it's like, well, I work as well, so like, how can that be my sole responsibility? And she's like, well, I breastfeed him all day. It's like, yeah, but I can't get up all night because I have to go to work the following day. So we have to share that as well. She's like, well, you're not breastfeeding him. And it's like, but that's biologically impossible.
Can't help that.
You obviously have these kind of like bickering little arguments that I think every couple on the face of the earth will have. You know, there's no such thing, I don't think, as going through parenting without that. But yeah, I was far more attentive with T than I am with Otto, as an example. And that doesn't mean that I'm not attentive with Otto. It's just like, I think all of those little wrinkles get kind of ironed out. Like when we first had tea, he would have to sleep like in our room because we were worried he might stop breathing, you know, all of this irrational stuff, or just like, oh, well, we're wrapping him in this sheet. Maybe he'll undo it and suffocate on the sheet, so we better be able to hear him. Whereas like Otto, born, we just shoved him in another room and, you know, so we could sleep and he's fine. You know, he sleeps through the night, no problem. And I'm sure T would have been like that had we not been so on top of it.
Yeah.
So it's quite nice, actually, I think, to, well, care less in a roundabout way.
Yeah,
it is true. You do become more relaxed, and it's good to hear that you have the same little niggly arguments when they're first born that we all did as well.
Absolutely. Now, Vogue and I have certainly had our moments like any couple. Vogue is a very strong, independent, Irish, fire-breathing dragon, you know what I mean? So kind of like naturally, given that I am quite an opinionated, strong male character who, you know, we clash from time to time. But we've also learned to love and appreciate each other for who we are, type thing. So I think our relationship now is far better than it was when we first met.
Yeah,
you know, and I don't know if that's normal, you know, I hope it is for married couples all over the world or whoever's listening to this, but we certainly feel very lucky that that's the case with us.
Yeah. And then you seem like you're nailing parenthood with three. So do you think there's a chance of a fourth on the table?
Are you going to do a Joe Wicks on us and just present a baby at 20 weeks?
Yeah. No, I'm not saying yes to the Joe Wicks thing. But no, yeah, imagine. Yep.
Yeah.
That's it. We're ping-ponging around the idea of a fourth. Like, we have a good day, we both want a fourth. We have a bad day, we don't want a fourth. And, you know, in our current, we live in an apartment, which is a beautiful apartment, but a fourth would be quite difficult here. So, you know, it would involve buying a bigger house, which we're interested in doing. But, you know, there's a few things I think that would need to happen before we could comfortably have a fourth. Mm-hmm. Look, we love kids. We would love to have another little girl, two and two. You know, Gigi, my daughter, the daddy-daughter thing is absolutely real. Like I am, like, she's the little apple of my eye. I try my absolute hardest, like, not to treat them differently. But I find myself treating them differently, like, not good and bad, but, like, I'm certainly a bit harsher with my son.
Mm.
And I say son, but I have two sons, obviously, but one's literally a baby, so I'm talking about Theodore. Yeah, like, she can kind of get away with murder, has me completely wrapped around her little finger, will no doubt get whatever she wants from me, whereas, like, with T, it is a bit different. I've actually spoken about this in therapy, because I have the occasional bit of counselling, just because I have counselling even when I feel like $1 billion, because I like the uninterrupted flow of conversation that is like personal to me, that doesn't feel egotistical, right? To just sit there and talk about yourself. Because it's quite difficult actually to chat to a friend about yourself for an hour uninterrupted.
Yeah.
So it's quite nice, and you kind of air stuff out and you get, you know, some view that is completely unbiased, right? To your situation. So I have kind of counseling from time to time, even when, as I said, even when I feel like perfect. And I talked to him about that, actually. And you know, there's all kinds of reasons why that might be, but it's a daddy-daughter thing, right? Do you have daughters?
I have one of each, so I have an elder boy and a younger girl, same as Sarah. We're both similar in that sense.
Yeah. And what are your husband's relationships like with the daughter versus the son?
Well, my son... still to this day. He's warming to my husband, let's just put it that way. I mean, he's so obsessed with his mummy. It's literally like, yeah. He often goes, oh, daddy, go away. I just want my mummy. Or I don't love you, daddy. I just love my mummy, which is quite brutal. Now he'll like sit next to my husband, might let him carry him up the stairs, might let him bath him, might let him put him to bed. My daughter gives more attention. She's clever. She'll play the game and she'll go to daddy when she wants something and daddy will normally cave because he's getting the attention that he's wanted for the last 3.5 years. So, you know.
Sounds pretty familiar, to be honest.
But our daughter she's 18 months. So we haven't quite got to the stage where she's talking. She just babbles, really.
I think 18 months is like the best age.
It's turning.
I love 18 months.
Yeah.
Like the look and feel of 18 months is like the sweetest thing ever.
Yeah, they're sweet. Except the tantrums are, they're very different. I mean, our little girl is strong-willed. She will lie on the floor and kick and scream until she gets her own way. And as soon as she does, she gets up, which is completely fine. Give me the chocolate. Off she goes. Fine.
Yeah.
See ya.
Yeah, I find my son is at that age with the like rough play with daddy and wants daddy to fight and all of that. And my daughter's only 15 months, but she's starting. I can see her starting to wrap daddy around her little finger for sure.
Yeah, it's a thing.
It's alarmingly devious. Mm.
How old are your kids, Spencer?
How old are my kids? My kids are 5, 3 and turning 2 in April.
God, 2. Oh, so, okay, so our kids are more in line with your younger 2 kids.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Anyway, I feel like we're going to move on from fatherhood and move on to all the many other things that you do, which I don't really know how either of you find time. Both you and Vogue just seem to be doing things all the time. It amazes me. It makes me feel confident that one day I'll be able to juggle all the many plates. But I want to start with Clean Co. Now, you have mentioned multiple times that you struggled with alcohol throughout your 20s. I mean, same as most of us. I feel like we were the generation of binge drinkers, and a lot of people I know now are turning to sobriety because the anxiety is either so bad when they're slightly hungover or alcohol just doesn't agree with them and it makes them sick. So can you tell us more about this experience and why you created Clean Co?
So I always looked for jobs kind of where being an entertainer or being loud or amusing, you know, was kind of part of the package. So I ended up in the city. I was trading contracts for difference at one point, which I won't bore you with, but basically they're this awful, like, leveraged product, which are incredibly dangerous to get involved with. It's like you're basically betting and you're leveraging your bets and you can lose more than your initial investment. And it's just don't buy contracts for difference, basically, unless you're very willing to lose loads of money, which I don't think anyone is really. Then, you know, I worked for a financial spread trading company that was owned by ICAP, and ICAP is the kind of largest brokerage in the world. So I had a view that I wanted to work at ICAP, ended up working at ICAP, and all of this is like alarmingly social, very heavy booze scene. Like, if you went into ICAP, and you were the perfect candidate to get the job that you were after. And you ended the interview by saying that you were sober, like for health and wellness reasons. And you wanted to just be able to smash it, like, you know, smash the ball out. You wouldn't get hired. They basically tell you to fuck off.
Wow.
Drinking is a very important part of that role. And I'm not even joking, right? So, like, you would be, you're in the pub every single day at lunch, drinking, and then you're back in the office to mess around, I suppose. It's quite full on. So anyway, long story short, again, developed a bit of a habit, shall we say. It didn't feel like a problem at the time. But, you know, drinking numerous pints a day, followed by, you know, wine in the evening, you know, a bit of whiskey, whatever. And then my role was essentially to entertain banks, and, you know, I would do whatever they felt like doing. So I would take them to the box and we would go out like all night, and I'd need to be at my desk at 6. And so you're just drinking, just, you know, to kind of sustain the exhaustion, I suppose, you know. And then you just crash at the weekend, or you'd go out on your own steam at the weekend, and then it's all back in for another week of kind of alcohol abuse and a bit of trading. Made in Chelsea came along at a similar time to that. So I'd been at ICAP for just about a year. Made in Chelsea came along. I thought it'd be an interesting, you know, thing to play with. Always wanted to be in TV or media or whatever assumed that we'd just jump into that, that it would be cancelled after a series, but I might be able to leverage, you know, that one season into doing something else in TV. I had no idea that it would grow arms and legs in the way that it did. Mm. So, you know, ICAP agreed to let me go and do this show. I did the first season whilst also working at ICAP. So that was doubling down on the... So I was at ICAP, boozing, filming in the evening, boozing, back to ICAP. You know, so there was just this, like, it was a really tempestuous cycle of just always drinking. It began to have a really negative effect on my health. I gained a lot of weight. I was, you know, 100 plus kilos. I'm only 5'11", depends what shoes you're wearing. Yeah, I would kind of sit on the tube on my way home to my then girlfriend's and wake up at the end of the tube line, you know, just like age, because you'd like literally pass out on the tube. So like it wasn't good, right? I was very short on sleep. And pretty unhealthy at the time. You know, many years go by of kind of this style of drinking. Throughout most of my 20s, I drank to excess. Main Chelsea was no help, really. You know, the best scenes, the most dramatic scenes, which is, of course, what that show trades on, were filmed drunk. Drinking was encouraged a lot of the time in order to make you say certain things that you perhaps wouldn't say if you were of sound mind and body. and all of a sudden the thing starts to grow, and you know, everything was fine, and I turned into the bit of the villain which I actually really loved, and started wearing all black, which I'm wearing today, and you know, and it kind of became this little thing that I was, this kind of like tempestuous character, which I never was really. Growing up, I was always a nice, sweet boy, really. Like, my mum kind of found it quite hard to understand. And the drinking started to put some distance between my dad and me and my brother and me, both of whom were really, really hardworking, successful people. And I was mistaking the television fame for success. Mm. And it's not. There's a difference, right? And we were on a very popular TV show and we were very well known. But like, I wasn't earning good money and I was destroying my health. So yeah. It's kind of like, what is the priority here? And it took me a long time to realize that Made in Chelsea was just not a priority for me. So yeah, anyway, so, you know, met Vogue, really didn't want to lose Vogue. Had done lots of other TV by then and had developed, yeah, just really bad drinking habits. You know, now I'm in my late 20s, call it, about to turn 30. I'm also 35, by the way. Did I say I was 34?
Yes.
I have no idea why I said that I'm 34. And actually, I take the piss out of Vogue the entire time for getting her age wrong. I got my age wrong today. I'm 35.
You really did? You're 35. Yeah. Okay, good.
You knew
know.
That, did you?
No, I didn't actually know that. Sorry, no. I should have done a lot more research on you and written
some notes. I'm pretty sure, I think I'm 35 anyway.
When were you born, Spencer? When were you born? I'll be able to figure this out.
1988, 6th of August.
Yeah.
I'm 35.
You're coming up to 36.
Perfect, good. Anyway, so what was I going to say? So no, drinking was bad. You know, I'd be boozing pretty regularly to the point where I just thought it was completely normal, surrounding myself with people who drink all the time as well. You know, when Vogue fell pregnant, the divide between us was really noticeable. I just decided to knock it all on the head. So one day I woke up feeling a bit hungover from the half bottle of whiskey I drank completely unnecessarily the night before whilst I was watching a film. And I just thought to myself, actually, I've got a real chance of becoming a serious loser here if I don't get my shit together and I don't change my relationship with alcohol. Vogue is going to go like this and I'm going to go like this and we're going to break up. And I'll always regret it because this, I feel like there's action I can take here to make sure that doesn't happen. And in true me style, just dove into teetotalism, loved it immediately, found it quite easy actually at the beginning because it was such a big difference, you know, and I understand it's difficult for some people, but you know, for me, if I make a big decision to do something, I'm pretty good at sticking to that. Yeah, about 5 months in, started Clean Coat because noticed that there was a mad gap in the market for that non-alcoholic cocktail experience. Yeah, the experience of having a cocktail was lost when I became teetotal. And I felt like I was suffering socially for a positive decision that I'd made. And it was a shame that, like, you know, few deem yourself to be overweight, so you decide to take up running. That's a positive decision. You know, you want a clearer mind, so you decide to start lifting weights, go to the gym. That's a positive decision. Giving up alcohol for whatever reason in some circles feels like a negative decision. Feels like you're making the wrong choice. You might be scrutinized for your behavior. I get DMs every single day. Oh, hey, mate, like I've had the best dry January in the world, but now that it's February, all my friends are putting me under so much pressure to drink. Like, what's your advice? I just say, get new friends.
Yeah.
Your friends forcing you to drink alcohol or making you feel like you need to drink alcohol means that you're in a different place to them. Mm. Put them on ice for a bit. Nobody really needs that kind of friend. But anyway, yeah, we wanted to create a line of spirits that could mix any cocktail that you know and love without any kind of repercussions from alcohol. But we wanted to focus really on taste and flavor profile and create gins and whiskies and rums and stuff that could really stand shoulder to shoulder with booze and give you that awesome cocktail experience, that sophisticated grown-up cocktail experience, you know, opposite to the mocktail, that might mean that you can fit into a social situation without sticking out negatively and feel included.
I mean, when you first started Clean Co, I remember that it wasn't really a thing. I mean, there was a semi-movement, but the shift hadn't really happened. Whereas I'm guessing you've kind of grown when this whole revolution has taken place, because there has been a massive shift in the last 5 years, 6 years, from people being like, oh yeah, well, I would never stop drinking, to people actually thinking, God, I actually really need to for various reasons. Yeah. But it is really sad that there is still this society out there where people are like, oh God, you don't drink, you're so boring.
I think it's gone from feeling like a trend to feeling like a movement.
Yeah.
Not only are teetotal people or people who moderate their alcohol very effectively or people who drink very rarely, you know, but spend most of their time teetotal, it feels very normal to me, that kind of behavior. Mm. Like, in fact, you know, we have people rounds, we offer people drinks. People very rarely come round and go like, oh yeah, I'll have a gin and tonic. Just doesn't really happen anymore. And we don't make any effort to choose friends that have good relationships with alcohol. Like, we have a lot of friends that drink like fish, but they kind of don't drink like fish in the way that they used to drink like fish. I think everybody, you know, most people that I come across, unless you're in the pub, right, like are literally making an effort to have a greater and better relationship with alcohol. And I think that's largely driven by a desire to be healthier and more well. It's also driven by having access to quicker and better information. So, like, you know, podcasting wasn't really a thing.
Yeah.
Like, a few years ago. Now, if you listen to Andrew Huberman's episode about the effects of alcohol on your brain, you will feel less inclined to drink that day and possibly less that week. And he's a neurobiologist at Stanford University. He's incredibly well balanced. He offers up information in a really digestible way that is not biased, you know, that shouldn't cause any concern. He's one of many people who discuss, you know, alcohol and the negative effects that it has on your mind and your you know, your personality, but also the people around you. And by the way, I'm not anti-alcohol, and I'm not suggesting that people shouldn't drink alcohol. People should do whatever they want. But I think people are beginning to understand what drinking alcohol regularly does to a person.
Yeah, and I think, especially as parents, I think, as you said, we've got more information out there now to understand the health effects of alcohol. But as parents, being hungover is the worst. You're not present. You're not engaging with the kids. You just want it to be bedtime again and have a break.
Yeah. They can feel it as well, I think.
It's like poking your eyes out with small sticks. Oh, having a hangover with children. It's
awful. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, what is your advice to anyone who is looking to step away from alcohol? I mean, how did you do it? Did you just go cold turkey? Did you, like, what would you advise people?
I went cold turkey. I replaced time that I would have spent drinking with exercising. So, like, if I would ordinarily meet my friends in the pub at 2, I would go running at 2 and, you know, just try and create better habits. I became absolutely obsessed with work. I became obsessed with making my wife proud as well, of, like, me being, like, super straight-laced. That was nice and kind of worked quite well. Not getting her to be proud of me, but just worked well for me to keep me driven. I also think it's probably easier now to be sober than it ever has been before. Like, back when I would abuse alcohol, you either drank or you didn't, basically. And like, if you weren't drinking alcohol, you'd be having a Diet Coke or a sparkling water or something that would be considered a serious compromise, right, on a gin and tonic or a beer or something that you might be looking to drink. Now, if you were to use, you know, non-alcoholic beer as a good example, there's very little compromise between having a beer and a non-alcoholic beer. They're amazing, right? Like, if you take Lucky Saint as an awesome startup, like, that is an incredible beer. Like, you know, there's no real way. I doubt you'd tell the difference if you gave it to somebody who wanted a beer, right? And there's loads of examples of great non-alcoholic beer companies. You know, nowadays, if you're skeptical of the non-alcoholic market, just try it, right? Like, if you're a beer drinker and you want to give up drinking beer for a while, drink non-alcoholic beer. Like, it's not amazing for you. There's calories attached to it and stuff, but there's no alcohol. So just, like, I think you'll notice very little difference, unless, of course, you're drinking to get drunk. Then, of course, you probably won't enjoy the non-alcoholic beer.
No.
But I would argue that, firstly, being drunk isn't very fun. And I think, like, people don't really think of it this way. But, like, getting drunk can be quite fun. Being drunk is not fun.
Yes.
Right? Like, nobody has ever woken up after a massive night and gone, ah, God, if I could change one thing about last night, I would have drank more. You know, like, nobody has ever said that. It's an interesting thing. If you're drinking socially and you almost don't want to be feeling drunk, then drink non-alcoholic beers or have some Clinko, because it's the feel and the experience of it is pretty similar.
Yeah.
And that wasn't available back when I was giving up. But yeah, there's amazing products out there. When you are trying to break a habit, it's the behavior side of things that is quite difficult to change. Like, if you smoke cigarettes, you're used to opening a pack of cigarettes, having a cigarette, lighting the cigarette. It's a part of your day, and then not having a cigarette is breaking that behavior, which is a difficult thing for some people to do. Same with a after work drink. It's Friday. What do I do on Fridays? I have an after work drink. Cool. So, and then it's kind of like, oh, what am I going to do instead of doing that? So I think if you can keep the same behavior but change the product, so if you usually go for an after-work gin and tonic, go and have an after-work clean gin and tonic, you might find that the experience is almost identical, but you're not drinking.
I was going to ask, do you ever feel like having one? Do you ever think, God, I really want one today? Or do you not miss it at all?
Yeah, so I don't ever kind of wake up and feel like, oh yeah, I'd really love to drink today. And by the way, I'm not completely teetotal. So I will drink alcohol very rarely.
Okay.
But like, I don't want to be that person that can't do what they want. Said I'm not anti-alcohol. I find that I operate at a much higher level and I prefer my life when I don't drink. That doesn't mean to say that I'm some teetotal, you know, robot that can't drink. Like, if I feel like having a drink, I will have a drink. That's kind of incredibly infrequent. Like, it's not something that I would plan.
Yeah.
I wouldn't look at my diary and go, ooh, here's a, you know, Saturday where I haven't got anything on. Let's go drinking. Like, I don't feel the urge to drink alcohol at all. So my relationship with alcohol is completely fine now, and it was always more of just a bad habit. Like, it was just something that I was so used to. So now that I've broken that habit, I was teetotal for 3.5 years, didn't touch a drop. I don't know, like, now you might catch me having a drink like a handful of times a year. I wouldn't say that I abuse alcohol at all.
Yeah. And actually, do you know what? I've always found that the first drink is always the best drink. Every drink after that doesn't actually taste as good. I often only have one now, but I spent years binge drinking and binge smoking.
Yeah. Yeah. We might, I think if we're able to do that, then that's great. You know, I think some people unfortunately can't do that, but I feel like also it's almost directly correlated to responsibility. As you guys said, with kids, if I destroy myself on a Friday night, my weekend is completely ruined, yeah, right? Like, yeah. I'm not there for my kids. I find my kids irritating. I'm really disappointed in myself. I beat myself up. Like, I haven't had that experience in years, but like, that is how I would feel, right? And it's kind of, yeah, Vogue's a bit of a binge drinker. So like, she won't mind me saying, no, but not in a bad way. So Vogue doesn't like the taste of alcohol. Vogue will drink like to get drunk from time to time with her friends or around us and me and whatever. She hasn't drank in like 6 weeks now.
Yeah.
So like, it's not a regular thing, you know, and she basically has a relationship with alcohol where alcohol's never really played like some big gross part in her life. So she'll do that every so often. She always deeply regrets it. She always says she's never going to drink again when she does it. And a few weeks go by and she does it again. But there's nothing wrong with that, right? And it's kind of, if you're questioning your relationship with alcohol, then you should probably address it and change something, because people that don't have issues with alcohol don't question their relationship with alcohol.
No.
So, like, I think if you're thinking, God, like, I'm feeling hungover again, and this is happening quite a lot, and I wish I wasn't feeling this way, then take some proactive steps to change that. Whereas, like, if you're just having the odd drink from time to time and it doesn't bother you at all, then you're probably doing nothing wrong.
Yeah, and I think now there's so many more options on the market. Like, even when we were pregnant, I say, like, we pretty much were both pregnant both times at the same time. There wasn't really many options out there. Like, you'd have a really sugary mocktail and then you wouldn't want anything else. But now there's so many options.
Thanks to Clinker.
Yes. There's so many options out there for you. So how did you go about starting Clinco? Because there wasn't really anyone else doing it at the time.
I took inspiration from Seedlip. So Seedlip was the only non-alcoholic spirits brand in the world that existed at that time. I thought it was like a really beautiful idea, and I really liked the brand. And I was sober for about 4 months, 5 months before somebody introduced me to Seedlip. I'd never heard of it. I'd never seen it. I'd never seen it advertised anywhere. And I was at a party and somebody said, oh, you're not drinking anymore. Do you want a non-alcoholic gin and tonic? And I was like, what's that? I was blown away by the idea of it. Then, you know, I became pretty enthralled with the brand. I took the bottle away with me. I tasted it with tonic. I made different cocktails with it. I was kind of trying to figure out why they hadn't gone down a gin route. It was made with like peas, bark, hay. It was kind of a niche within a niche, right? So it was like a niche product within a niche market. And I was just thinking, God, like, why didn't they just make like a juniper-driven gin drink, right? Like, I don't really understand why this is kind of pretending to be gin when it could just be gin. And that's how it started. I reached out to Seedlip, asked if I could be involved with them. They said that they only work with chefs and like Michelin-star restaurants, and they had a very different strategy to what I would have wanted anyway. So I went and made my own thing. And yeah, so I flew around Dublin and Cork, and I went to lots of distilleries trying to find the perfect partner to make a kind of really heavy citrus juniper-driven non-alcoholic product, and we called it Clean Gin. And that's how that got started, basically. And now we're the, in terms of global volume sales, we are the largest non-alcoholic spirits company in the world.
Wow, what a title.
Independent, sorry, I should throw in the old independent word. We're not larger than Gordon's or Tanqueray, but we are the largest independent non-alcoholic spirits brand in the world.
That's amazing.
We are larger than Seedlip.
Hey, well, there you go.
I know, I had to chuck it in, I had to do it.
I feel like I genuinely have a million more questions for you, but you have been with us now for 55 minutes, so I'm going to slowly start to wrap this. My final question for you is, what is next? I mean, you are spinning all the plates. I feel like we haven't talked about your TV show with Disney Plus. We haven't talked about your many podcasts that you do. We haven't talked about your experience on MasterChef, which I'm quite gutted about. So we might have to just have you back on. Maybe we'll have them both. That would be fun.
I was about to say, hey, listen, let's do a part two.
Let's do it again.
Yeah.
I'm loving it.
Yeah. Hey, I've really enjoyed this. We'll do a part two. That's no problem. You know, surely you don't really want Vogue. I'll just come back on again. That's no problem.
We could just have you again and then have Vogue. Whole season.
Not that we're being greedy or anything, but yeah, tell us what is next for you, Spencer. What is on your horizon in the next couple of months?
With my newfound relationship with alcohol, I've kind of really enjoyed pushing my boundaries physically and seeing what's possible to achieve. And over the last few years, I've competed in and completed some of the world's hardest foot races, and I've really, really like enjoyed doing it. And my brother used to run loads, and I used to think he was just mad, right? And basically, like, he did this race called the Marathon des Sables one year.
Wow.
which is the world's toughest foot race, and he came 150th or something out of 1,200 people. Yeah, and it's six and a half marathons in 5 days in the Sahara, and I just thought to myself, I'm going to do the Marathon des Sables, right? So I signed up to it, did it, came 69th, Then I did a couple of other ultras, one in Arctic Sweden. And unfortunately, on the third day, I had to be pulled out because I tested positive for COVID. I was really sick, actually, which was annoying because I'd done all the hard bit. Then I did the Jungle Ultra, which is this 250-kilometer foot race through the Amazon rainforest.
And
I got a kind of real bug for pushing myself to the extremes. And at the moment, we're working on a world record, and it's going to be in a desert somewhere. And I'm not being ominous for the sake of it. We haven't confirmed it. We haven't locked it
TBC.
In yet. But there's going to be loads of running. Like loads. It will be a world record if my friend and I are successful. I've just realised this is a bit of a silly story because I can't tell you exactly what it is, but I'd love to tell you what it is. It's basically we're gonna cover some very, very serious distance on foot. So much so that nobody's ever done it before in the setting that we're going to be in. And I'm working on that at the moment. We're looking to just get that completely bomb-proof so we can announce that. Film a nice little clip to announce it. But it's going to be a really awesome experience. Not that it's like some ego trip, but I've been obsessed with the Guinness World Record book since I was like a little kid. I used to get it all the time. I've always wanted to be in that book, to be honest. I don't think I've ever said that before because it sounds a bit late.
No.
But we're going to be looking to raise like enormous amounts of money for charity as well to make as much difference to as many people as possible for this. I think it's going to be a 30-day period.
Wow.
So working a lot on that. You'll notice potentially that I'm in running gear. So as soon as we're done here, I'm off for a 3-hour trot. Wow. There's an awful lot of running at the moment.
You've done some incredible ultra marathons. Like
I did a triathlon recently, and it was the hardest thing I've ever done. And now you're going out for a 3-hour jog. I mean, literally.
Well, it will be a jog. I'm just going to listen to podcasts and kind of cruise along at snail's pace. But we'll see. That never really happens. You get like all excited and whack a song on and nail a bit of it, and then you kind of find yourself miles from home with a dodgy knee. But anyway, we'll see how that works. So I'm focused a lot on that. I'm in the Stand Up to Cancer Bake Off lineup this year.
Fun.
Yeah.
Oh, that is really fun.
Be joining Prue and Paul Hollywood. Yes, of course, Paul Hollywood. In the tent this year. I've got a TV show for the BBC coming out. We're doing bits and bobs. But I can't thank you guys enough for being interested in interviewing me and chatting to me. It's been really fun.
Oh, well, thank you, Spencer. We've loved having you. And I mean, I'm going to say this, but I feel like everyone will know where to find you if they want to reach out. But say it anyway. If anyone wants to reach out and say hi, where can they find you?
I have an Instagram account.
Do you? Really?
I do, yeah. It's @SpencerMatthews with 2 T's. you can find me there. Shoot me a DM. I'm notoriously terrible at getting back to DMs, but I do read them from time to time. So there you go.
Oh, thank you. And as always, everyone, please feel free to rate, review, subscribe. If you've liked this episode, leave us a comment. And if you'd like to find us on Instagram, you can find us at We Are Mother Tongue. Thank you so much for your time today, Spencer.
Thank
you've
you,
been
Spencer.
Incredible. Happy running.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Mother Tongue. We hope you enjoyed it. As always, please feel free to rate, review, subscribe, and leave a comment. We always love to hear from you. Your support really means the world to us. And if you know any mums or mums-to-be who'd be interested in listening to our podcast, please feel free to share. You can also find us on Instagram @WeAreMotherTongue. Until next time, mamas.